Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Notice how some homes sell faster in your neighborhood? It's not luck. It's local know-how. RE/MAX agents know their streets, schools, and communities inside and out. And with RE/MAX, those local pros are everywhere. Which means when you're ready to buy or sell, you'll get trusted neighborhood insight that puts you a step ahead. Reach out today. RE/MAX, the experts close to home. Each office independently owned and operated.
Hello and welcome to the intro of Brokenomics, because in the last Brokenomics I filmed, I gave advice to Nigel Farage, and it was actually before Rupert Lowe came out and launched Restore. And what I did in the Brokenomics you're about to see is I thought long and hard about, because I don't like Nigel Farage, and I think he's weak. And duplicitous and cunning and backstabbing and all, anyway, all the rest of it. But at the time of the recording, he was the best we had. And therefore, okay, I thought, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give him the best advice that I can give him on how to message, how to talk about it, how to perceive the political situation. So I thought long and hard about it, and I prepared the Brokenomics that you're about to see. Now, I'm still going to put it out, but the thing I would note is that shortly after that was filmed, in fact, the evening after that was filmed, Rupert Lowe then came out with his video. And he hit every single point that I made in that video without needing the memo. He got all of it. And everything that I'm saying in the video that you're about to watch is stuff that Farage couldn't get to. After 35 years in politics, and whatever it is now, a year or 18 months at the top of the poll, he could not understand all of those points I was making, and Rupert nailed it first time. So I'm sure you've seen the Rupert video. Watch the Brokenomics that you're about to watch, right? And then go and watch the Rupert Lowe thing and see how Rupert nailed it. But anyway, the advice stands. The advice is good. It's still important. It's still necessary to understand the mechanisms behind it. So without further ado, here follows the actual Brokenomics. Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I wanted to make this one basically a direct video to Nigel Farage, because it looks like Nigel Farage is going to be the Prime Minister in a very short period of time. And so I kind of wanted to take this opportunity to give him my well wishes and actually some practical advice. And that begins with this, that Britain is not a democracy in the way that you think it is, Nigel. The situation you are actually inheriting, you will enter office with a democratic mandate for change, but you will not inherit a system that is capable of delivering it. Britain no longer operates as a democracy in the sense that elections are determined by policy directions. Elections are now determined by who administers a fixed set of constraints. You are not taking control of a sovereign decision-making apparatus. You are stepping into a credential-weighted compliance system whose primary function is risk management and not national direction. And that distinction is going to define your premiership. You will quickly discover that decisive power flows through institutions that own the downside risk, are insulated from electoral punishment, and can veto actions without appearing to be political. These are things like the Treasury, because they are fiscally legible, they own market confidence, they're the regulators, they're courts, they're the quasi-NGOs. Now, these bodies, they don't need consent to block you, but you do need their consent to act. And they're not going to oppose you publicly. What they will do is they will render your proposals unworkable or irresponsible or non-compliant. You will be presented with clear pathways, and each pathway will be validated against things like legal risk and compliance cost and international alignment and reputational safety. You get to choose which pathway. You may not redefine the constraint set without triggering institutional resistance. Anything outside those boundaries will not be argued against. They will simply fail to proceed. This is how veto power hides behind deniability. This system does not arise from conspiracy or malice. It arose because the state adapted to survive complexity. And over the decades, the policy chains have lengthened and attribution becomes opaque. Being wrong became career-ending. Being inert became safe. And the institutions, they responded rationally to that. Judgment was replaced by process, and decisions by compliance, and responsibility by auditability. Independence was introduced to stabilise market and expectations, and it gradually evolved into veto without ownership. The result is a state that persists by shedding blame but not solving problems. You are not necessarily facing bad actors. You're facing hardened incentives. What your mandate will and won't let you do, you will be able to change rhetoric, and you will be able to change personnel, and you'll be able to signal priorities, and you'll be able to absorb public anger. But you will not automatically be able to override Treasury constraints. You won't be able to reverse judicial interpretations or violate international treaties. So the first mistakes that you need to avoid: do not interpret this resistance as sabotage or incompetence or lack of will. If you treat this as a loyalty problem, you're going to lose. This is a structural problem. Structures do not respond to speeches or pressure. They respond to incentive change. If you govern as if it still operates as a preference aggregation democracy, you will burn political capital without seeing results. Stop asking what the voters want and start asking what actions are currently impossible, regardless of what they want. And these impossibilities define the real constitution that Britain operates by. Your job is not to argue with them. Your job is to move the boundaries of what is actually permissible. If you try this change, understand it, be clear-eyed, markets will react. Legal challenges will multiply. The press will frame everything as recklessness. Institutional actors will brief against you anonymously. You will be accused of undermining norms rather than being wrong. This is the price of reassigning downside risk back to elected authorities. If you are not willing to pay that price, the system will continue unchanged, just under different management. The core reality you must internalise is this: you are not entering office to lead the system. You are entering office to renegotiate who carries risk. Until downside risk is reattached to elected decision makers and removed from processes, independence and abstraction, your mandate will be absorbed, diluted and neutralised. This is the wall. Everything else follows from whether you choose to hit it, go around it or pretend that it isn't there. This is the core insight you must internalise. The British state no longer governs in the classic sense. Every major institution optimises not for outcomes, but for minimising legal exposure, minimising reputational volatility, maximising audit defensibility. This is not a culture failure. This is the rational end state of a system in which being wrong is punished harder than being ineffective. Your mandate for change will collide with this immediately. What this means in practice is that you will encounter endless consultation, procedural delays, requests for impact assessments, warning about unintended consequences. These are not stalling tactics in the normal sense that we think of them. They are risk elevation mechanisms. Within the system, action creates personal downside, and delay distributes it, and inaction eliminates it. The safest move for any official is to ensure that nothing traceable to them causes harm, even if that means nothing improves. No one is allowed to be right too early. One of the least understood dynamics you will face is that in risk-prossing states such as Britain, early correctness is indistinguishable from recklessness. If someone acts early and is right, the counterfactual, what if you were wrong, is unknowable. The risk appears unjustified. The personal exposure is absolute. But if someone waits and it is wrong, blame is diffused, circumstances are cited, process and compliance will shield them. This is why innovation is dying inside the state, and why your most capable people will hesitate. The moral language trap is this. As outcomes weaken, the state that the system substitutes moral language for performance. Compassion replaces capacity, fairness replaces effectiveness, and inclusion replaces delivery. And this is not ideological, it's defensive. Moral claims cannot be audited, but outcomes can. Expect every failure to be reframed as virtue under pressure. And the walls that you will hit, first of all, legal risk. This is going to expose us to judicial review, Prime Minister. Translation being, no one wants to own the downside of this. And the reputational risk, this will damage trust, Prime Minister. And the translation is, future blame is being priced in. An audit risk. This isn't best practice, Prime Minister. The translation, it cannot be defended later. Now, these are vetoes without veto language. And you might be tempted to think, issue stronger directives, demand pace or replace personnel. This will fail if the risk structure remains unchanged. Officials will comply procedurally while neutralising the substance of what you're trying to do. The system is very good at performing obedience while preserving inertia. If you want outcomes, you must reroute risk, not demand effort. This means you've got to shorten decision chains. You've got to force explicit trade-offs. You've got to make non-decision carry downside. Protecting those who act early when they're authorised, and removing safe harbours that reward delay. And until that happens, you are going to be pushing water uphill. And again, be clear-eyed about what this is going to cost you. Accused of recklessness. Failures will be personalised to you. Successes will be normalised as inevitable. And institutional warnings will leak out to the press. The system is signalling that you are absorbing risk that it previously shed off. And if you're not willing to take that exposure, nothing changes. The practical implications, you cannot fix this by motivating or messaging or loyalty. You must decide whether you want to control without consequence, which is the default, or consequences with control, which is the only path to change. One produces stability without purpose, the other produces visible risk, potentially real outcomes. The operating rule that you should carry forward is every time the system tells you something is impossible, ask who avoids owning the downside risk if this goes wrong. The question will reveal where the block is, who benefits from inaction, and what must change if you want movement. Also this, you need to understand that Parliament no longer functions as a primary decision-making body. It functions as a signalling and shock absorption layer. The job of Parliament, the real job of Parliament, is to transmit acceptable norms and convert system decisions into public narratives and absorb anger that would otherwise target the institutions that really do have power. And this isn't so much a failure of MPs as individuals. This is the role that Parliament has structurally been reassigned in the British system if you properly understand what is going on. So legislative debate is not about persuasion or discovery. It's about record creation. What matters is not what is said to change minds or even what passes on the day, but what exists on the record that can be used later by courts and regulators and inquiries and compliance bodies. In practice, speeches become future citations and amendments become legal tripwires and ambiguity becomes leverage. Parliament is supplying the downstream veto raw material that they can use. The trap that you're going to be pushed into, you will be encouraged to win the argument in Parliament or deliver powerful speeches or pass declaratory legislation. And it feels like governing, but it's not. The system is comfortable in letting you say almost anything, provided it can later reinterpret, narrow, and neutralise whatever it is you said. Parliamentary victory without control of interpretation produces symbolic wins and, in all practice, status. So you've got to understand that this configuration solves three problems for the administrative state. First is legitimacy. Parliament provides democratic cover without requiring transfer of control. Blame management. MPs absorb public anger while unelected institutions remain insulated. And continuity. Policy direction persists regardless of electoral churn. Parliament stabilises the system by decoupling voice from consequence. So if you treat Parliament as a debating chamber, you lose. If you treat it as a constraint-shaping tool, you gain leverage. The three rules that you should internalise for this is, first of all, legislate for hierarchy and not aspiration. Replace have regard to with explicit priority ordering. Ambiguity empowers courts and regulators, but not ministers. Second, you've got to force explicit trade-offs onto the record. Make downstream bodies understand, and you've got to say to them, state which outcomes they are choosing not to pursue, not just the ones that they're choosing to pursue. And you've got to bind interpretation early. You've got to draft with judicial use in mind. If it can be read two ways, it will be read two ways. So the key mistakes to avoid: don't rely on speeches or moral appeals or popular majorities to force compliance. Parliamentary theatre satisfies public expectation while leaving real machinery of power untouched. Your task is not to speak louder in Parliament. It's to reduce how much interpretive freedom Parliament leaves behind. Now let's look at what your first 100-day strategy might be. Remembering that you've got to force risk back into the system. Understood risk. And this isn't so much of a revolution, this is a rerouting exercise to make the system work. You've got to create a single doctrine, which is decision ownership. You've got to issue prime ministerial instructions, back it by statute whenever you can, of course, that advice is advisory. Decisions are ministerial. And outcomes attached to named office holders. Make this boring, procedural, but universal. You've got to pick one narrow domain and concentrate risk there. Don't fight on all fronts. Choose one area with clear public mandate, measurable outcomes and visible failures. My preference would, of course, be remigration, but nevertheless, I'm providing the best advice I can to you. And you've got to force a single accountable minister. You've got to force a single delivery check, a single published counterfactual. You've got to introduce, on most of the stuff you do, automatic sunsets. Outcome tests for new regulations, expiry unless renewed. And apply that retroactively to existing regulations. Expiry unless renewed. And renewal conditions are based on outcomes, not intentions. And what that will do is we'll start cleaning up the drift that has loaded up our system to the point of ineffectuality. You've got to explicitly protect early movers. Issue written indemnities and career protections for officials acting under ministerial instructions. And if you don't do that, they won't move. Make non-decisions visible. require departments to publish when decisions are deferred, why, and who signed off on that delay. You've got to get to the point where delay acquires reputational cost. And this won't fix the system in 100 days, but you can change expectations about where risk sits. And once the pocket of the state operates under real downside, others are going to notice. You're changing the incentive structure, not just when you get criticised. So, Parliament gives you legitimacy. The administrative state manages risk. If you want outcome, you've got to use Parliament to constrain interpretation. Use executives, the executive, you're part of the government, the ministers, to reassign downside. And accept that resistance is the signal that you're touching on something real. You've got to understand, Nigel, that Britain is governed less by explicit rules than by a whole bunch of inherited assumptions about what is allowed, what is suspicious, and what must be justified. And these assumptions that you're going to inherit, they're not written down, and they're rarely defended, and they operate as default priors inside the institutions. Effectively, what I'm saying is that they shape policy long before any vote is taken. Historically, these assumptions, naming these assumptions, were dangerous because elites kind of still remember choosing them. They were actively policed, and enforcement was confidential. And that's no longer fully true. Many of these assumptions have become embedded where they're no longer consciously held and so expansive that they're just colliding with reality. And that creates an opening. Expose them, name them, and show them and show how far they have drifted. Force a recalibration. And this only works when free conditions hold. And in Britain, increasingly they do. The assumptions that you can name, and name them directly, is that economic growth has never visibly advantaged the native population. And that was once a guardrail put in for best intentions, but now it's a distortion that suppresses wages and productivity. It's especially true of young white men who are getting the rawest deal in all of this. Name it explicitly. Other implicit assumptions. Cultural continuity is inherently suspect. And again, that was brought in by people with best meaning, I guess, as a check on chauvinism, but it's become warped. Name it. Another one. International legibility outranks domestic coherence. The adherence to international agreements or charters or whatever deal has been made at the international level always outranks domestic coherence. So say it plainly. Admit it. And it was once a source of strategy, I suppose, a survival strategy, but now it's a source of democratic paralysis. Bring it into the open. And they also assume that stability means consensus, but not outcomes. Again, name it. Now, these were all originally trade-offs, and they've hardened into defaults, not case-by-case trade-offs. That's a vulnerability. So, and this is the crucial tactical distinction. You don't name them as accusations. You name them as unexamined inheritances. The correct move is not to say this assumption is wrong. You could be softer. You can say this assumption may have gone too far. Is it still the right balance? Get people discussing what the balance is, what those trade-offs are. And that reframes the issue from morality to calibration. So you're not attacking the values, you're questioning the parameter setting. So state it as an axiom. State it plainly. We are currently operating as if X is always preferable to Y. Show its justification. You can say, look, this made sense when conditions A, B, C, relevant. And you can demonstrate drift. You can say those conditions no longer hold, but the rule remains. And you can pose balancing questions. Should we rebalance or continue by inertia? And as soon as you start framing it like this, resistance is going to look irrational rather than righteous. And why this works now, even though it didn't before. Three structural shifts have made this powerful today. Institutional memory loss. Many officials are enforcing assumptions that they cannot explain. They can't justify those trade-offs anymore. An outcome pressure. Assumptions that once reduced risk now generate visible failure. And legitimacy fragmentation. The system can no longer rely on trust us as a response. There is no trust left. If you name these axioms, you force the defenders to re-own it and relitigate the trade-offs and the assumptions that came with it. Right. And that's going to be very uncomfortable for them. It is often going to be fatal to their authority. That's how you can use this. Got to think about how the system is going to respond to this. When you name an assumption directly, expect accusations of tone rather than substance, or claiming that you're changing the subject, or reframing calibration as extremism. But that's not refuting you. That's boundary defence, underexposure. The moment the defenders stop saying why the assumption exists and start saying how you should speak, that means you're winning. And these assumptions, they collapse when they are just stated clearly and linked to cost and forced into explicit trade-offs. And once an axiom is visible, it can be debated and it can be limited and it can be partially reversed. Unspoken rules are absolute. Spoken rules are negotiable. So the strategic takeaway for you is there are two kinds of constraint in the British system. Those that are actively defended and those that are enforced out of habit. Those especially you need to name early. And your advantage is that many of the most damaging assumptions now fall into the second category. You're not proposing a new ideology. What you're asking is if the old defaults still serve in the modern world. And that's not radical, that's governance. Every system runs on assumption. And the danger is not choosing them. Used carefully, naming the invisible is no longer a provocation, it's a way of restoring your agency. Axioms that you must name directly. Britain has been governed for decades now by an unnamed but decisive axiom that population inflow is preferable to economic adjustment. Right, that assumption was never voted on and it was adopted quietly as a stabiliser. It meant that whenever the system faced labour scarcity or wage pressure or fiscal strain from demographic ageing or debt sustainability, the response was not reform or repricing or retrenchment, it was importing more people. The axiom solved short-term problems. It created very big long-term ones. And your first task is to say it out loud. Look, this axiom of just import me people rather than deal with economic consequences, it's drifted far beyond its original justification. It began as a pressure release mechanism, and it has become the default growth model that suppresses wages and props up weak productivity and inflates housing demand and delays fiscal reckoning and it erodes democratic consent. If you name it plainly, you will force the real question. Is permanent population growth still the right substitute for hard economic choices? And that question alone gets you to reorder the debate. And do be explicit about the trade-offs. Don't even try and soften them. If you intend to reduce immigration materially, you must pre-commit to the consequences. And the public will tolerate pain if it is named honestly and linked to purpose. Here are some of the unavoidable trade-offs that you can talk about. Wages will rise and margins for businesses will fall. Labour scarcity will reassert itself. Wages will increase in care, hospitality, logistics and agriculture. And corporate margins will be compressed. And a number of low productivity firms will fail. This isn't a bug. It's a mechanism by which the economy adjusts. Second, debt assumptions will be strained. Just come out and say it. Slower population growth means slower headline GDP growth. Debt to GDP projections are built on perpetual inflows. They will break, and it will force spending constraints and reprioritization and visible cuts. Immigration, mass immigration, has been masking this fiscal reality for years. Expose it and reveal the bill. Third, the population is going to age. Without inflows of lots of young men from North Africa, the median age is going to rise. And dependency ratios that the OBR rely on will get worse. And any increase in native birth rate will take 20 years to show up. Say it explicitly. Demographic repair will not mature while I am Prime Minister. Make it clear you're playing the long game. And when I put it like that, it's obvious why previous governments never did this. Every previous government tried to reduce immigration without affecting wages, control borders without touching debt assumptions, signalling toughness without accepting economic slowdowns, and they all failed. They treated immigration as a moral problem or an enforcement problem, when actually it was functioning as a prosthetic arm on the economy. And you can't remove this prosthetic without having to learn your skills over again and readjusting to it. So you're not necessarily even arguing, you can do if you want, but you don't even need to argue that population inflows are always wrong. You're arguing that they've been overused to avoid necessary adjustments. Framing matters. The calibration position is immigration is a tool, not a growth model. It's not a wage suppression device. It's not a debt management strategy. And as soon as you say it out loud, the reduction becomes rational rather than punitive. And the order matters. Name the axiom publicly. Explain what immigration has been compensating for. State clearly that the balance has gone too far. Get people debating it. And pre-commit to the costs that you're going to face. Yes, there will be wage pressure. Yes, there will be fiscal tightening. Yes, there will be slower growth. Yes, the population will age. The short-term pain to long-term sovereignty. That's what you've got to sell. Higher wages. Fewer people competing for households. The institutions need to be forced to adapt. And it's a demographic strategy which is rooted in citizens, not migrants. And then tighten immigration. People will support you if they understand why you're doing it and they understand there'll be costs, you disarm your opponents. Now, when you do this, expect Treasury warnings about growth and business backlash over margins and media focusing on closures and price rises and, oh, this 80-year-old firm has just gone out of business because they can't hire people, or meaning that they're not prepared to pay the wages, or the business was insufficiently productive in order to pay the correct level of wages. It's a moral reframing of economic adjustment as cruelty. That is what they will go with. Right, and this is not opposition to immigration control. It's resistance to losing the adjustment buffer that immigration provided, the prosthetic that it was providing the economy. If you have already named the trade-offs, all of this resistance is going to lose its force. You shouldn't be afraid to say, yes, prices will rise. Some firms will fail. Debt assumptions will have to adjust. And the demographic payoff will come after this parliament, once I'm out of office. and the cost of building an economy that works without importing people. If you can do that, you'll get the backing, make it clear, people will understand and accept. So the key takeaway is that immigration policy cannot succeed unless it's subordinated to labour repricing, to fiscal realism and demographic honesty. Once you expose the axiom and recalibrate it openly, the debate shifts from "Are you anti-immigrant?" to "What kind of economy do we want to run?" And that is a fight that you can win if you are willing to own the costs. Also, future Prime Minister Nigel Farage, the British Constitution, you've got to understand at this point, it's statistical. Metrics are the law at this point. The core reality that you've got to internalise is that Britain is not ultimately governed by statute or votes. It's governed by a series of metrics. What constrains action in practice is not parliamentary arithmetic or manifesto commitments or even legal formalities, but bond yields, GDP trajectories, credit ratings, regulatory benchmarks, international legal NGOs, indices. All of these are operating as a shadow constitution. And they're powerful precisely because they're presented as technical and apolitical and inevitable. They're none of those things. So the axiom you must name here: markets and institutional legibility outranks demographic choice. And this is something that has emerged gradually to stabilise borrowing costs and reassure investors and to embed Britain into an international system. But it is hardened into a rule. And if policy disturbs these metrics, it is considered irresponsible, regardless of how much of a mandate you have, regardless of how many votes you win in Parliament. So naming these axioms matter because you have to reverse the hierarchy. Numbers now discipline politics. Politics no longer disciplines numbers. The left has tried to grapple with this idea, but they can never... They often say things like, why are we dominated by the bond markets? They're trying to grapple with this without understanding really the mechanism that's what's going on. They haven't seen how we've been lulled into this. And actually, they're addressing the right question, because none of the trade-offs have ever been faced. So you're going to recognise these constraints when you come up against them, because the Treasury will come to you and they'll say, sorry, but this is unaffordable. Or the markets will react before the legislation is even passed. And credit agencies, they're going to, you know, issue warnings based on expectations, not outcomes. They just go straight out there what they expect the policy to do. Right? And legal and NGO frameworks will be cited as immovable facts. Right. None of this is going to get framed as opposition to you from within the system. It will be framed as reality asserting itself. And this is the moment that most leaders retreat. Every Labour and Tory Prime Minister have always retreated when they got to this point. And you need to understand what is actually happening. These metrics have power because they concentrate risk. You know, a small movement in yields can cause a cascade through the entire system. They shift blame. Decisions are framed as what the market requires, not political choice. And they preempt debate because by the time Parliament speaks, it's already been priced in. And this allows institutions to veto policy without appearing to choose it. So don't deny the power of markets and don't pretend these metrics don't matter or posture against global finance, you know, the typical silly left-wing idea of how to handle this. Because that path leads immediately into a loss of credibility and control. Equally, don't surrender policy to metrics as if they were laws of nature. Your task is re-ranking, not denial. So the correct framing is metrics are tools, not masters. And they inform those trade-offs that you've always got to be thinking about and articulating. They don't dictate values. And this reframes the issue from reckless politics to responsible economics. Talk about which costs do we accept and which do we reject. And as soon as you frame it like that, democratic choice is going to re-enter the system. And again, be explicit about the trade-offs. Bond yields may rise temporarily. Growth may slow. Fiscal headroom may tighten. Spending plans built on these optimistic assumptions are going to need revision. And you must also state why you are bearing the cost, because it restores policy sovereignty. It forces honest budgeting. It ends the illusion of cost-free governance. Short-term pain is the price for long-term control. And again, I believe the British public will be willing to accept it if you make it explicit and clear. So you've got to require the Treasury and regulators to show which assumptions drive their projections and which outcomes are prioritised and what alternatives were rejected. And you've got to time bind market discipline. Make clear which risks you accept now to reduce larger future risks. Right, the markets will respond to credible narratives, not just austerity. And you've got to create political ownership again. Keep going back to that. Political ownership. Stop pretending that these forecasts are neutral. Named ministers. Get attached to them assumptions and revisions. And sequence the reforms. Do not go after every metric at once. Pick battles where you can, where it's visible, you've exposed it, and you've won the debate, which you will if you frame the axiom correctly. And again, here, the resistance is going to look about warnings about confidence or accusations of irresponsibility. You'll get anonymous briefings to the press. Sudden reverence for norms. And that's not economic speaking. That's authority defending itself through a series of abstractions. If you have already named the axiom, and the trade-offs, this resistance is going to lose all of its power. Metrics became dominant because they were the only thing left that could discipline a state as complicated as the British state is today. And your goal is not to abolish them. You've got to re-embed them within political judgment. Because a system that is governed only by numbers loses legitimacy. That is exactly what we see now. A system that ignores numbers loses sovereignty. That's where we are now. You've got to explicitly choose the balance, not just inherit whatever you get. Your line should be something like, we will be judged not just on what the numbers say this quarter, but on whether those numbers reflect a country that still governs itself. And that's telling markets that you're serious, not naive about the decisions that you're making. And again, name the assumptions, name the trade-offs, pick, and explain that you're doing it for the long-term health. Once you start recalibrating immigration and wages and fiscal assumptions, the statistical constitution will become your main battlefield. If you pretend it isn't there, it's going to stop you. And if you submit to it entirely, it's going to hollow out your mandate. Name it, contextualize it, and own the trade-offs. Then you can move. This is where most reform projects die. And it's also where the first real shift in incentives can occur. So let's consider what your failure mode looks like coming into Downing Street. The core danger, the greatest risk that you face is not overreach, it's absorption into this system that I'm describing. The British system is extremely good at taking leaders like you, elected for change, with a mandate, and converting them into caretakers of inherited constraints, while ensuring that you own the disappointment of your supporters for not delivering. And this happens, it happens all the time, it's happened my entire life, it happens quietly and procedurally, and it does it, more to the point, with your apparent consent. The first invisible wall will be something like, this is not how things are done, Prime Minister. Early in your term, your civil servants are going to be saying that your proposed actions are, they might be popular and they might be electorally mandated and they might be superficially straightforward. So they won't be rejected outright. Instead, you'll hear, this raises concerns. We need to be careful. There are legal and reputational risks, Prime Minister. And you're going to be offered slightly modified versions of your proposals that protect these existing assumptions. And they defer the real cost. And that they leave veto power that we've talked about untouched. And if you accept these as reasonable compromises, you have already lost. You are being absorbed into the system. And understand, look, you are going to be praised when you respect independent institutions and soften rhetoric and you defer to their process and you accept Treasury constraints when you avoid the rocking the boat. Right, and this praise, when you get it from within the system, that's a warning signal. It means that you are governing in a way that the system considers safe. And what safe means here is no reallocation of risk, no exposure of the axioms, no forced trade-offs. And you're going to be called grown up. And you will also be neutralized in that same process. Capture by advisors, not enemies, is something you need to be aware of. You're not going to end up getting captured by ideological opponents. You will be captured by competent, well-meaning insiders. And they will appear to share your goals. And they just warn you about feasibility and suggest sequencing later and help you avoid early failure. Right. And the thing is, they're probably sincere. They are also the system's immune response. And each concession is going to feel small, but the cumulative effect is going to be total. You'll have the illusion of progress. You'll be at a point, if you go down this path, to legislation passed and speeches made and task force launched and enforcement announced, and the public will see motion, but outcomes will not change. And why? Because immigration numbers will remain structurally high. Wages will remain suppressed. Housing remains scarce. Debt assumptions remain untouched. You will discover that activity is not leverage. The system in this case still has the leverage. And then the blame will be transferred to you. Once it has become clear that the outcomes have not shifted, the system executes its final move, which it always does. Failures are personalised. Constraints are forgotten. Your mandate is reinterpreted as incompetence. This has happened to, again, all of the politicians in my lifetime, increasingly more so with the last three or four. And then they start saying things like, he promised too much and he didn't understand complexity and populism doesn't work. The institutions that block you will present themselves as stabilisers who prevented much worse damage. And it's the oldest move in the book. And then you're going to end up hated like everybody else, like Keir Starmer is right now. And from the public's perspective, nothing will have improved and the costs continue rising and trust erodes further. And from the system's perspective, continuity has been preserved. Risk remains externalised. The blame has been successfully reassigned to you. And you will become completely indistinguishable from any late-stage Conservative government or technocratic Labour administration. Different language, same outcomes. And that is how mandate decay happens again and again. And in the end of the term, the failure will look like you're accused of betraying your supporters and dismissed as reckless by your opponents. But you will be quietly respected by the institutions for not breaking it, I think. And nothing fundamental will have changed. And this is not an accident. This is the default outcome for leaders who make the mistake of operating skill for structural leverage. And the key mistake that produces all of this is confusing governing well inside the system with governing at all. The system rewards leaders who manage expectations downwards and absorb blame upwards and leave incentives untouched. Those leaders are praised as mature, and they are also replaced and forgotten. So the warnings you should take seriously is if 6 months into office, the Treasury is comfortable, regulators are calm, markets are reassured, the press is bored, but the outcomes are unchanged. That doesn't mean that you're winning time. That means that you are being processed into the system. Failure does not look like chaos. It looks like smooth continuity with new party branding. The danger is not that the system fights you. The danger is that it will accept you on its own terms. And that's how every recent government has lost its mandate without even realising that it happened. And then you see, the last three or four prime ministers with a silly look on their face wondering what happened. It's because they got absorbed into the system that I'm trying to describe to you. So let's turn it around now and look at what would your success actually look like? Well, first, and this is completely non-renegotiable, you redefine success. If you define success as immediate delivery or rapid material improvement or visible transformation in one term, you will fail even if you do everything else perfectly. The success condition under these constraints is different. Success means shifting incentives and timelines and expectations so that improvement becomes structurally likely, even if it's not yet visible. But you are not here to finish the repair. You are here to make sure that repair is unavoidable. The core move: change the time horizon of politics. Britain has been governed for too long, most Western nations are, on artificially short time horizons. Immediate reassurance, cost deferred, permanent drift. Right. Success requires you to stretch the public time horizon and not pretend that those costs don't exist. And it's not pessimism, it's the restoration of credibility. The public doesn't need perfection. They need to believe that tomorrow can be better than today because somebody is finally telling the truth about the trade-offs. So what success actually looks like is, by the end of one parliamentary term, success is going to look like, you know, constraints are visible and not, and they're contested but not hidden, and that Treasury assumptions are debated openly and trade-offs are named in public documents, and that unavoidable decisions are shown to actually be choices. And even if outcomes lag, the opacity has ended. That alone is going to restore agency. That will put Britain back on the path to being restored. And the downside risks, they need to visibly move upwards. Ministers need to be clearly accountable for outcomes. Delay and non-decisions need to carry reputational costs. And officials act faster because the cover that minister is providing is explicit. It sits with them. And the state begins to move again. Not smoothly, but it does move decisively. You'll see immigration falling because an adjustment is happening. Wage pressures are rising in tight labour sectors. Some low productivity firms are going to fail. And housing pressure begins to ease at the margin. And population growth slows, but it's understood why. Because it's not being propped up by immigration. And what the public will see is coherence, not cruelty. And yes, growth will be slower. Be honest about it. Headline growth may well soften. Productivity focus will replace population-fueled expansion. And the fiscal language, it will shift from fantasy to prioritisation. And the markets may grumble, but they will adapt, and quite fast actually, to credibility faster than denial. They are very long on credit, on denial. If the bond markets want to invest in denial debt, they've got a lot of options. Give them credibility, and I think you will be pleasantly surprised. And the system will resist you if you're succeeding. But if you followed my advice, it will fail to neutralize you. And that's a really important success signal. Legal challenges will increase, and media hostility from the establishment press will intensify, and the institutional discomfort will be obvious. Yet, your key reforms will survive. Your precedents will be set. Vetoes will no longer feel absolute. And this resistance without reversal is progress. and the public will start to recalibrate their expectations. Perhaps the most important outcome will be fewer promises, but more honesty and less theatre, more seriousness. People will begin to believe that the state is acting for them, telling them the truth, making choices rather than hiding behind process. And that belief is the seed of long-term legitimacy. What success does not look like and must not be promised, be explicit about what will not happen quickly. Birth rates will not show up this Parliament. Demographic repair is generational. Debt reduction is slow. Institutional culture and change will lag the incentives. So say it clearly. Paradoxically, fewer promises, the more the trust will raise. And the emotional component of this. People will accept sacrifice if they believe three things. One, the pain is real. Don't deny it or sugarcoat it. Pain is shared, and the elites are not exempt. And the pain has direction. It leads somewhere. Your task isn't so much in this respect economic, it's psychological. Hope does not come from comfort. It comes from meaning and trajectory. The line that defines success is, by the end of the term, if the average voter can say, sure, things are hard, but for the first time in decades, it feels like the country is being run for our future, not just managing to get through to the next day. If that is the common sentiment, you have succeeded. Now, it doesn't necessarily mandate or guarantee electoral success, but you will have put Britain back on civilizational success if you do this. The deeper truth is that systems like Britain's do not collapse because leaders take risks. They collapse because leaders refuse to. If you tell the truth about trade-offs and reassign risk honestly and accept slower improvement in exchange for a real direction, you will not be loved by the institutions. You may not even be universally popular, but you will have done the rarest thing in British politics. You'll have given the public a credible reason to believe that tomorrow can be better than today. And that is what success looks like under this constraint. Nigel, I have tried to give you the most sincere and helpful advice I possibly can. I don't know if you're going to see this, but I put a lot of thought into this. Pretty sure this is exactly right. Please heed it.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.